in the book of Daniel. We did an introduction last week, and last week we set the stage of Babylon had been attacked. The people had been taken away into exile, and now they're in Babylon, and it's their new home, but it's their home away from home. So how are they going to live? And today, we're coming to Daniel chapter 1, and I want to start with a question. Would you say that you are pure? Would you say that you are pure? Other words that could be used, undefiled, not stained, clean, uncorrupted. As Daniel and his friends, their city was destroyed, people were killed, horrendous things were done. They're carried off to Babylon, and we're going to read this morning that they resolved in their hearts to not defile themselves, to remain pure. That's telling me one thing right off the bat, that even though life was messy, even though they're reeling in pain, even though they're living in a world that's broken and beyond recognition, who knows how many of their family were killed, they were kidnapped and taken away from home, and in that, despite all of those circumstances, they resolved in their heart to not be defiled, to remain pure. To be defiled is all about an inner purity. All of life can be messy around you. Circumstances can be horrendous. But inside, it's almost like Daniel and his friends are like, you can beat us up, you can take us from our parents, but you can't touch our soul. And today, as we ask that question, are you pure? We want to set our hearts to resolve, like a New Year's resolution. That will last, and not just last a couple of weeks, but to not be defiled by the world around us. So why are we going through the book of Daniel in the first place? Well, of course, our practice for Sunday mornings is we use God's word as our directive. So I don't just sit up here and babble about my favorite topics, because I'm not an expert in all of the topics of the world, and so I'd run shallow pretty quick. So we come to God's Word, and I like to bounce back and forth between the Old and New Testament. So sometimes we're in the New Testament, and other times the Old Testament. There's different genres, some narratives and other teaching sections and poetic sections, and so moving around. But more than the diversity of the Scripture, I like to ask, what does our church need right now? And that's a tough question, because sometimes we need a good old kick in the pants, right? Other times, we need a gentle, comfort, caring message. And there's such a diversity of people, circumstances that we're moving through, and what you need might be different than what you need. But something as I was looking at the book of Daniel that struck me is how many issues they faced of how to deal with the society around them. They're living in a country where they're wary of the government and they're not quite sure about the leaders in charge. That there's moral injustice issues all around them. They're bombarded with all these questions of how do we live in a society that's got nothing to do with God, that's turned their backs on God. How do we remain pure? How do we remain in society? And so I thought that would be pertinent to us. So in the book of Daniel, with all of these different cultural issues, we too are asking, just like Daniel and his friends were at home, but it was a home away from home, us too. As we're home here in the Comox Valley, in Canada, how do we live here knowing where our true home is? Daniel and his friends, for the first time in their life, were away from the watchful eye of their parents. Do you remember those moments growing up when mom and dad left? What did you do now that there was no accountability, no one looking over your shoulder? You were free to do anything you wanted. I remember a few times my brother and I would go into the kitchen. No parents there. It's like, let's just look for sugar and make something good, and marshmallows. And we'd take the icing sugar and we'd fill our mouths with the icing sugar and then we'd just blow it out. I don't know. Maybe it would be better if my friends were into vaping and I could do something like that. But it was exciting, all this white smoke all through the kitchen until we realized mom and dad are coming home and now we have to actually wipe all the counters. But when parents are away and you're out from the watchful eye of your parents, you do weird things, and all of a sudden you want to try new things out, and some kids, they'll watch the TV they're not supposed to watch, or they'll smoke, or they'll drink because mom and dad aren't around, or whatever it might be. And of course, your classic is kids who've been at home under the watchful eye of their parents, and then for the first time, they're alone at college, and they just go wild, right? And it's like, what's happening? There's no integrity of their acting one way, and then their parents are gone, and they live a completely different way. Daniel and his friends showed an amazing amount of integrity. That what they were on the inside is how they wanted to live out consistently around them. And so they resolved to not be defiled. So let's read Daniel chapter 1. Let's get a picture of what's happening here. And then we'll look at it in detail a little bit more. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylon, and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men, without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter into the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel resolved to not defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should I see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would have my head because of you." Then Daniel said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please, test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of other young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So the guard agreed to this test for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine, and they were to drink, and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. And at the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, Nebuchadnezzar, the king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. The intent of Nebuchadnezzar was to bring these men into his service to fully assimilate them into their lifestyle and culture. Now, Nebuchadnezzar believed that people could change. And in believing people could change, he was a ruthless monarch. He was an absolute monarch, but he didn't rule with total oppression. He aimed for cultural immersion. Let the foreigners come, we'll assimilate them, and they can become insiders. He did this in a number of different ways. First of all, he stripped them of their Jewish names. He took the core of who they were, their very identity, and he changed their names. He wanted to eradicate any sort of outward distinctive that their names might signify. Now, Hebrew names from these Jewish boys, they bore witness to the God that they believed in. The name Daniel means that God is my judge. And he's not just the judge in the legal sense, but like in the book of Judges, the judges were the rulers of the country. They would care for the people. They would lead the people. They would guide the people. So every time someone said, "Hey, Daniel," they were remembering the Lord as my judge. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to strip them of that and take away any memory of their people and their God. The name Hananiah means the Lord shows grace. So if they weren't allowed to say grace at the table, they could just say, "Hey, Hananiah." And they're saying, "The Lord shows grace. Can you pass the potatoes," right? And they're remembering that God is gracious. Azariah means Yahweh has helped. God is our helper. Mishael means as God is, demonstrating the uniqueness of God, how he's so different, separate, and holy from anyone else. So to Daniel, they gave the name Belshazzar, which means may Bel, or another name for Marduk, their chief god, may Bel protect his life. To Hananiah, they gave the name Shadrach, which means under the command of Aku, who is the moon god. To Abednego, servant of Nabu, who is the son of Marduk, their chief god, and to Mishael, who was called as God is, the uniqueness of God, they changed his name to Meshach, who is like Aku, the moon god. And that one was a bit of a linguistic parody. The two names sounded similar, where one is saying God, who is like him. Now they're saying, who is like the moon god? And so they're playing with it. Is this whole form of social engineering. Let's change these people's names, their core identity of who they are. And we aren't given any narrative on what Daniel and his friends thought about this. They didn't revolt, that's what it was. Some commentators suggest that throughout the book of Daniel, he's misspelt these names a number of times. Almost deliberately, where it's like he's saying, it doesn't really matter what you call us. Change our identity. Now you have a name. Does your name have a meaning? Imagine it does. Some of you might even know it. But in Canada, most names, it's just a name. But names carry connotation and they build on the character of who it is. Like think of a teacher of a school trying to name their own children. Right? Their spouse says, "Yeah, but we call them this." "Ooh, I had a student with that name." Write that one off. Okay, what about this name? Yeah, that one's not going to work either, right? And it doesn't matter what name they're going to choose, there's going to be an association with that particular kid in their class. And depending on what that association is, it'll be a good thing or it'll be a bad thing. When people say your name, what do they think? What association goes? We've got a ton of Jims here, maybe even more Eds. So if someone says Ed, right? What are you thinking? What character comes to mind as you associate it with that person? We see that Daniel and his friends maintained their identity. Didn't matter what the world called them. Didn't matter how they changed it. They had an integrity. And in doing that, the world couldn't take away who they were, even if they could change their name. The other way that Nebuchadnezzar was wanting to assimilate these guys was through their education. He enrolled them in the pagan academy called U of B, University of Babylon. I don't know, I'm just making that up. I'm sure back home their parents had little bumper stickers for the back of their carts. Proud parent, honor roll student of U of B. But in that education, they learned so much. It says that they excelled in this learning, and they excelled in the knowledge and the understanding and all of the literature. They dove right in, and they became excellent students. And as they did that, they learned the makeup of the hearts and the minds of the people that they were living with. Now, here in Canada, we have the luxury of choice when it comes time to education. Daniel didn't say, "Well, actually, I want to go to the Christian school." He didn't have one. He was forced to go into that education. I think I'm going to homeschool. No, he had to. We have the luxury of choice. And most of the world does not have the luxury of choice. Education, the choice of education is a privilege that we get to enjoy as a country like few other times in history. Daniel and his friends didn't have the luxury of choice, and there they were put into this education system. And there, the goal was to assimilate them to become Babylonian, to train them in the gods and in the education and the philosophy and everything about it. But we see that at the end of the day, Daniel and his friends stood firm, that even though they received an external education, in their hearts they'd set apart Christ as Lord. Education is not to be feared. As followers of Jesus, we want to learn to think critically. You listen to the news and you're bombarded with information. You watch movies and it's teaching you a worldview. You read books and it may not agree with the theology that you have. How can you learn to discern well? I'm amazed that although these boys went through that intensive education and they ended up at the top of their class, they didn't say, oh, I don't want to hear. No, they dove in and they learned. But in that, I imagine they had to do twice the work as all the other students. Just as followers of Jesus, when we're being educated, we need twice the work. Kids are at school, they're learning science, they're learning that there is no God, everything just evolved out of this mush and it came to being and life sprung from these amino acids. The kids need to learn the materials that everyone else is learning. But they also need to go home and they need to learn, how do we align this with our faith? Align might not be the right word. How do we understand this in light of our faith? And they need to do twice the work. And as followers of Jesus, we want to be diligent in learning and growing and studying so that we can say, yes, this is what the world believes and what they think and all of the facts, and we have a good understanding of it. But here's how it lines up with my biblical worldview. And so we need to put that extra energy in. And then we see that Daniel and his friends, they did not compromise with the world around them, and yet they became the most useful in the world. That's the case, right? When you can stand firm and not resolve to be defiled, that actually makes you more of a use around you. Now, the main point of this passage is showing that they recognize, okay, we're at home here in Babylon, but it's not our real home. It's just our home away from home. And in doing so, there's times where they wouldn't cross the line. They said, you can change my name, but you can't change my identity. You can teach me all of this education, but I'll still know who my God is. And then there's this whole issue of food, with the meat and the wine around them. Now, Babylonian culture put a high premium on physical image, right? The guard was worried they wouldn't look as good as the others if they changed their diet. And so officials in the country, they didn't just have to do a good job, they also had to look good. And we get that as Canadians, right? If you want a prime minister, who do you want? Someone that takes a good selfie. Because that's really important, isn't it? If they look good on the front of a magazine, they're a good leader. And that was the mindset of the Babylonians. I had a good chuckle when I read that in the commentaries on how much physical image played into the character and all that a person entails. So Daniel and his friends, they were fed the finest foods from the king's table. So they'd look good and they'd have a good physical image. But they said no. We don't want this. Now, of course, dissatisfaction with college food is nothing new, right? You go to your cafeteria and it's good your first meal or two, but after a while it gets old, right? A few of you are back from reading break here. How's college food? Is it great? Yeah. That wasn't the issue here. It's not like they just grew tired of the food around them. And they weren't just trying to be, well, let's be polite and eat the good food, but this one I really detest. I'm not going to have it. If you invite me over to your house and you offer me tea, I'll be polite and I'll drink it. If you offer me coffee, I'll say no thank you. I'm not a coffee guy. I don't like the taste. They tell me, well, it's an acquired taste. I'm like, why would I want to acquire a taste that I don't like? It doesn't make any sense to me. So I'll be polite and I'll drink your tea. But I'll draw the line at coffee. I'd rather a glass of water or orange juice. But I'll be polite. Daniel and his friends, that wasn't the situation for them. They weren't saying, well, the meat, it's not really up to our standards. We more like it charbroiled than like medium rare. No, that wasn't the case at all. They said no meat and no wine. And there's a few suggestions of what's happening here. And in doing this, we want to understand, okay, what is it? What line will we cross? No, what is it that if I go over here, that's actually going to affect who I am on the inside? You can change my name, whatever. That's not going to change who I am. But for Daniel and his friends, the meat and the wine was something where they go, no, that's going to actually affect who we are on the inside. And as Canadians, we're thinking, what? Like, we understand you hear about kosher food and Jewish culture. And, you know, well, okay, if they're putting pork or bat meat on the table in front of them, they're saying, that's not kosher. That's unclean. That will defile who we are. So that's one of the suggestions of what they were saying. But in these, there's a number of different suggestions of why people think Daniel and his friends said no to this. It doesn't explicitly say it in the passage. Another is the waiter comes out and he says, the soup of the day has been especially sacrificed to the God of the fields. And they're thinking, well, wait a minute. If the soup of the day has been sacrificed to these gods and we eat it, that means we're participating with that. That will defile us. We can't go there. Others are saying, well, sharing a meal with someone, this is the king's food. If you eat the king's food, that means you're actually fellowshipping with the king. And this Nebuchadnezzar was a bad guy. And they didn't want to associate with him. But as we read later in the book of Daniel, these guys are actually close to Nebuchadnezzar. They're in his palace. They're doing his work. And it doesn't seem that they're too worried about rubbing shoulders with someone and being associated with them and them getting hurt on the inside because of that. Now, throughout the Bible, of course, the Jews had their ceremonial laws about which foods they could eat and couldn't eat. Jesus comes along in Matthew 7 and he says, you know what? If it goes into your mouth, it's just coming out the other end. It's not going to defile your heart. It's actually what's in your heart that defiles you. And sometimes I wonder, why didn't God just start with that? Why didn't God just say, don't defile your inner attitude and not worry about all of those food laws in the Old Testament? Galatians chapter 3 explains it. Similar to in ancient customs, children had a guardian to protect them until maturity. And for Israel, the whole law and all of these dietary laws, Galatians 3 says, acts as a guardian until Christ comes. So in a sense, God is treating the infant nation of Israel as a child, guarding it with all of these rules and regulations and dietary commands in its early stages of development. Now, the obvious drawback of that, and we see that through the time of Jesus, is that it's dangerous to fall into the error of confusing the keeping of external rules and regulations with the real inner moral cleanliness. And then they can think, I didn't eat that food, that means I'm a better person than you are. And that means I'm accepted by God because I followed all of these laws. Now, when Jesus came, he canceled that system of food laws, as we see in Mark 7:19 and other places, and he gave us the Holy Spirit to indwell believers to give us an inner power to resist corruption. It wasn't just a law of stay away from it. Jesus gave us the Spirit as an inner power to resist a strength that even though we're to be in the world, we're at home here, we're mixing with the world around us and we can't escape the corruption of the world. But inside, the Spirit is leading us to a purity. Now, during Daniel's times, the food laws were in effect. But the thing that makes most sense to me is that throughout those meals, they would have had constant toasts to their gods. Just like nowadays, you go to Oxford or Cambridge, they still have a Latin grace said at meals by a scholar. That's part of their tradition. The Babylonian culture, they're constantly giving toasts to the god of this and the god of that. And all throughout the meal, they're giving these toasts. And that makes sense to me because they didn't just refuse the meat, they also refused the wine. And the wine, the Bible doesn't speak negatively against wine unless it's in excess. Later in the book of Daniel, wine takes a center stage at a party that Belshazzar threw. He had this famous party where he brings in the golden goblets that were from the temple in Jerusalem. And it's a calculated insult against God, because he fills these goblets with wine and he toasts the pagan gods of wood and stone. And in toasting foreign gods, to Daniel and his friends, that would be a compromise. They would say, no, that goes against who I am. I will draw the line there. That will defile me. So they refuse to be involved in this pagan drinking ritual that spelled out large letters on the wall, just like it did for Belshazzar, where God says, it's enough is enough. Your days are now numbered. And so the protest that Daniel and his friends had was against the idolatrous worldview of the Babylonians. And the Babylonians had so many different stories. Their creation story is that there was all of the gods emerged out of some sort of primeval combination of eternal fresh water named Apsu and the saltwater god Tiamat. So all of their gods emerged out of this soup that became the basic material stuff of the universe. Very different than the one true God, who isn't just part of creation and he happens to dig his way out and climb up to the top. But we recognize God, not just as one God and not many gods, but as outside and distinct of creation, where he has a hand over all. He created all. He's sovereign over all. Now, it would have been tough for Daniel and his friends to say no. And in saying no, I imagine they would have had a lot of fear going inside of them. It's not just because they were vegetarian and they're picky and they're like, I don't like that food, and I don't want... No, they said no, standing up for their ideals, and that could have cost them. There was a lot at stake for them not to eat meat. Their classes were at stake. Their reputation was at stake. Their lives were at stake. Pardon the meat pun. You're supposed to laugh more. Come on. I worked hard on that one. Maybe that's why it fell flat. Okay. It was dangerous for them to say no. They were sharing in the food of Nebuchadnezzar, the king. And Nebuchadnezzar was a bad guy. I'm looking around. Is this a PG audience? Because there's some things in the Bible that are worse than PG, right? In Jeremiah 39 and 52, two different times, it says, at this place Riblah, the king of Babylon, kills the sons of King Zedekiah. He forces him to watch it with his own eyes, and then he pokes out Zedekiah's eyes and puts him in chains. That's a mean dude. Kill all his children and then take his own eyes so that that's the last thing that he remembers ever seeing. He's cruel. He's harsh. He's mean. And he's the one overseeing Daniel and his friends. He's the one wanting to assimilate them into his kingdom, into his palace, to follow his ways. So for Daniel and his friends to refuse his food, it was dangerous. It wasn't just, oh, no, thank you. No, this was a big deal. Now, First Peter gives us some good instructions on how we're to make up our minds, especially when we're dealing with, how do we deal with issues and ideas around us. In First Peter chapter 3, starts off by saying, do not fear their threats, do not be frightened, but in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Starts off by saying, don't be afraid. And then it goes on to say, set apart Christ as Lord. And so they may have enjoyed the food. They may have said, this is good meat and this is great wine, but we're still going to say no. And in saying no, they were saying no to something. Maybe the food in itself wasn't wrong, but the whole culture of toasting the gods around it was wrong. And just as like in our own lives, there's many good things that we love and enjoy and we justify, But the question we need to ask ourselves is, would you give it up if it helped you remain pure? Often we say, well, I can manage it. I have a lot of self-control. I'm not affected like other people. Really? Daniel and his friends could have said, well, we'll just eat the meat, but we won't do the toasts. We'll drink the wine, but we just won't kind of participate in these other things. I remember one time we were in Tanzania and the witch doctor had come through town, a traveling guy, and he's digging in front of everyone's houses looking for curses and evil spirits. And he's giving this great big speech, and I'm part of the crowd, and I'm there with the village, and I'm watching, and I'm learning what's happening, and I'm standing there like this when everyone else is saying prayers like this. That's how they pray. They lift up their hands. And the witch doctor called me out in front of the whole crowd, saying, why don't you lift up your hands like everyone else? And I'm kind of like, nope, not going to do it. Like, I'm here. I'm at home in this different culture. But I'm not going to lift up my hands to these spirits and these prayers and these other gods. But many times, temptation, it comes in such a way that it's tempting. Right? That's the thing about temptation, is it's tempting. Sometimes we think, well, maybe I'd be tempted to do something that would be horrid and just despicable and I couldn't stand and, no, I don't want to do that. But temptation usually comes and it plays with our desires, doesn't it? It offers us a promise and it says, but what about? It just fit in here. It's not too big of a... And it will give all sorts of rationale and judgment against things. We're tempted to do things that we actually desire and long for. And saying no to temptation then not only becomes difficult, it becomes painful. Because we're saying no to something that we actually want and desire. But pain is okay. Pain is okay because if you say no and it hurts, you realize that you're saying no to it's offering you this promise, but it won't actually deliver. And the desire that you have for that temptation in the first place, chances are it's because this world we're living here is our home, and we have a longing for more. We have a longing to be at our real home with God forever. And because we have that longing, we can wait. We can be patient. We can know that one day God will satisfy those longings. And temptation usually wants to play with those, saying, but you can have it right now. You can satisfy yourself with so much more. And that's why when we read in 1 Peter, it says, set apart Christ as Lord. So we can say no to temptation and not defile ourselves. Because why? We've resolved to not defile ourselves. We've set apart Christ as Lord. Are there resolutions that you need to make in your life? A resolve for purity. Think through what that might look like. Things that you may need to say no to or not associate with. Daniel had his friends standing beside him. Who do you have standing alongside of you to help you in this? And as Daniel and his friends said no, just as if you say no to temptation, others around you may give you a bit of a sideways glance. What's going on? Why don't you just do this with me or whatnot? Daniel's telling us how he and his friends responded. He doesn't tell us exactly how we're to respond, and yet we can use him as a pretty good model in our response. Because if you're convinced in what Jesus wants of you and you understand the Christian worldview and the truths of what's there, should we not stand up for what is right? But then it leads to the question, how do we stand up? How do we respond? How do we protest against society? How do we say no? I love in 1 Peter where it says, as you've set apart Christ as Lord, you want to be prepared to give an answer to anyone that asks. And how do you do it? With gentleness and respect. And look at Daniel. Look how he goes about it. First, he goes to Ashpenaz. He's the chief official. He's the one that's changed their names. He's the one in charge of educating them. He's the one giving them their food. He's responsible. Daniel goes to him and he asks permission to do something different. I like how he doesn't suddenly just bang the table and say, enough with this. I'm not eating your meat anymore. No. Politely And in private, he goes to the chief official and he says, "Please, can we talk this through?" But the chief official, he's afraid. He admits his fear to Daniel, which is remarkable in itself. And the explanation is God gave Daniel favor and compassion in his eyes. And we can be sure that Daniel had prayed about this, that he behaved in a friendly and respectful way towards the official. He'd been earning his trust. And sometimes, when we have a strong conviction that I know the truth, isn't it easy to produce an aggressive attitude that just reeks of superiority and is off-putting? And that's the farthest thing of what we want. And just because we're passionate about, but this is true and that's so wrong. Even Jesus in Matthew 11:29 says he was gentle and lowly in heart. Doesn't mean he was a pushover, but he was gentle as he stood for the truth. And it's easy for us to forget that people are humans just like ourselves. That they're infinitely precious and they're made in the image of God. And sometimes we elevate ideas over people. And as we respond, as we say no to things, as we stand up for what's right in our culture, we want to remember that people are made in the image of God. And that our attitudes are to mirror that dignity, to care for them. Because we want them to know that Jesus gave his life for them, to love them, to purify them. And so we don't communicate in a way that's showing disdain and superiority. Now, it never occurred to this chief official that there could be any other way for his students to be handsome and good-looking apart from giving them the best food. So Daniel offers an alternative. And that's important, isn't it? Because sometimes people are just stuck in their way and to hear a different way of thinking, that never considered that before. But Daniel could see that there was no point in pressuring Ashpenaz too hard. So he goes to the junior official. And he says to him, he says it quietly and without fuss. He says, "How about we just try this experiment? We'll keep it on the down low. It's only 10 days long. Here's what we do." He provides an alternative. He doesn't just say, "I don't want this meat and wine anymore." He says, "Let's make a creative alternative for how we're to go about that." And after the trial, 10 days were up. They looked in the mirror. The acne had cleared up. Right? No more zits. Good looking guys. Turns out all of that meat was bad for their skin in the first place. I don't know if that's what happened. But it says they were looking better. They were looking well nourished. Daniel and his friends put up a protest. But they did it as participants in life. They weren't standing on the sidelines just calling out, "You guys are doing it all wrong." They were part of life. They were in the education. They were excelling. And they weren't observers outside of the system, but as members of the U of B, devoting themselves to their education, they said, "We want to see change, and we'll start in our own hearts." And Daniel, he had convictions to honor God, and he took his time. Right? He wasn't frantic and in a hurry. That's an important thing for us to remember when we stand up for what is right. We're not frantic. We're not in a hurry. Gentleness and respect. And God honored them. Nebuchadnezzar personally examined them after 3 years of their intensive course. Man, Ashpenaz must have been proud at that point. "Yeah, my students, they're top of the class. This is pretty good." They rose. God blessed them with great understanding and knowledge. But that doesn't mean that just like we stand up for what's right, that God guarantees now you're going to become an intellectual and administrative genius, right? We read other places where people stand up for what's right, and they're killed for it. So sometimes that'll happen. God gave them a special role for them to play. So my prayer through reading this is that we make a resolve in our own heart to not defile ourselves. To say, "I want my heart to be pure, I want to follow God, and yes, I will make the right decisions, and I'll do it in such a way that shows the purity in my own heart." And now we're coming to the communion table, where we remember Jesus. And as we read through this and we know I want to resolve not to defile myself, what about when you do? What happens when you're not pure and you're already defiled? I started with the question, are you pure? How do you answer that? Is your answer no? And we're told, just try harder, just don't defile yourself. And you're like, but I'm already so stained on the inside. And often, we know better. Man, I knew not to, and yet I did it anyway. And then I tried to stop, and I did it again and again. And we continually defile ourselves. As we come to communion, we want to look to Jesus, the one who was pure. In fact, the only one who was pure. So when I ask, are you pure? No. Each one of us are stained. Each one of us have gone wrong. Each one of us have hearts that are corrupted. But Jesus lived the perfect life. He came into this world to make it home here, but he wandered about as an exile. And all the while, he resisted sin. He resisted temptation again and again. And as he resisted, he then took his purity and laid it aside, took off his clean garments, and he says, give me your filth. He took your impurity on himself. He took your disgusting sin. He took your corruption. He took your filth, and he put them on himself as he hung on the cross. Why? To make the great trade. So that you could have his perfection and purity. So that when God looks at you, he doesn't see corrupt, tainted sin. He sees the blood of Jesus, which is perfect and pure, clean. So that you could stand before God and say, I'm not righteous, but through faith in Jesus, you've forgiven me and cleansed me. And that's where it comes from, faith in Jesus.